Her room was on the second floor. But she was no longer there. She wouldn't be coming out any more to say, "Hi, Mr. Wind-Up Bird." On a bitter cold afternoon in mid-February, I dropped in at the estate agent's office by the station that my uncle had told me about, Setagaya Daiichi Realtors. When I walked in, the first person I saw was a middle-aged female receptionist. Several desks were lined up near the entrance, but their chairs were empty, as if all the brokers were out on appointments. A large gas heater glowed bright red in the middle of the room. On a sofa, in a small reception area towards the back, sat a slightly built old man engrossed in a newspaper. I asked the receptionist if a Mr. Ichikawa might be there.
"That's me," said the old man, turning in my direction. "Can I help you?"
I introduced myself as my uncle's nephew and mentioned that I lived in one of the houses that my uncle owned.
"Oh, I see," said the old man, laying his paper down. "So you're Mr. Tsuruta's nephew."
He folded his reading glasses and gave me a head-to-toe inspection. I couldn't tell what kind of impression I was making on him.
"Come in, come in. Can I offer you a cup of tea?"
I told him not to bother, but either he didn't hear me or he ignored my refusal. He asked the receptionist to make tea. It didn't take her long to bring it to us, but by the time he and I were sitting opposite each other, drinking tea, the stove had gone out and the room was getting chilly. A detailed map showing all the houses in the area hung on the wall, marked here and there in pencil or felt-tip pen. Next to it hung a calendar with Van Gogh's famous bridge painting. A bank calendar.
"I haven't seen your uncle in quite a while. How's he doing?"
the old man asked after a sip of tea.
"I think he's fine, busy as ever. I don't see him much myself," I said.
"I'm glad to hear he's doing well. How many years has it been since I last saw him? I wonder. At least it seems like years."
He took a cigarette from his jacket pocket, and after taking careful aim, he struck a match with a vigorous swipe.
"I was the one who found that house for him, and I managed it for him for a long time, too. Anyhow, it's good to hear he's keeping busy."
Old Mr. Ichikawa himself seemed anything but busy. I imagined he must be semi-retired, showing up at the office now and then to take care of long-time clients.
"So, how do you like the house? No problems?"
"No, none at all," I said. The old man nodded.
"That's good. It's a nice place. Maybe on the small side, but a nice place to live. Things have always gone well for the people who live there. For you, too?"
"Not bad," I said to him. "At least I'm alive," I said to myself. "I had something I wanted to ask you about, though. My uncle says you know more than anybody about this area." The old man chuckled.
"This area is one thing I do know," he said. "I've been dealing in property here for close to 40 years.
"The thing I want to ask you about is the Miyawaki place behind ours. They've bulldozed it, you know."
"Yes, I know,"
said the old man, pursing his lips as though rummaging through the drawers in his mind.
"It sold last August. They finally got all the mortgage and title and legal problems straightened out and put it on the market. The speculator bought it to tear down the house and sell the land. Leave a house vacant that long, I don't care how good it is, it's not going to sell. Of course, the people who bought it are not local. Nobody local would touch the place. Have you heard some of the stories?"
"Yes, I have, from my uncle."
"Then you know what I'm talking about. I suppose we could have bought it and sold it to somebody who didn't know any better, but we don't do business that way. It just leaves a bad taste in your mouth."
I nodded in agreement. "So who did buy it, then?" The old man knit his brow and shook his head, then told me the name of a well-known property corporation.
"They probably didn't do any research, just snapped it up when they saw the location and the price, figured they'd turn a quick profit. But it's not going to be so easy."
"They haven't been able to sell it?"
"They came close a few times,"
the old man said, folding his arms.
"It's not cheap buying a piece of land. It's a lifetime investment. People are careful. When they start looking into things, any number of stories come out, and in this case, not one of them is good. You hear stories like that, and the ordinary person is not going to buy. Most of the people who live around here know the stories about that place."
"What are they asking?"
"Asking?"
"The price of the land where the Miyawaki house was." Old Mr. Ichikawa looked at me in a way that showed I had aroused his curiosity.
"Well, let's see. The lot is a little over 3,500 square feet, not quite 100 tsubo. The market price would be 1.5 million yen per tsubo. I mean, that's a first-rate lot, wonderful, setting southern exposure. 1.5 million, no problem, even with the market as slow as it is. You might have to wait a little while, but you'd get your price at that location. Ordinarily. But there's nothing ordinary about the Miyawaki place. That's not going to move, no matter how long you wait. So, the price has to go down. It's already down to 1,000,010 per tsubo, so with a little more bargaining, you could probably get the whole place for an even 100 million.
Do you think the price will continue to fall?
The old man gave a sharp nod.
Of course it's going to fall to 900,000 per tsubo easy. That's what they bought it for. They're really getting worried now. They'd be happy just to break even. I don't know if they'd go any lower. They might take a loss if they're hurting for cash. Otherwise, they could afford to wait. I just don't know what's going on inside the company. What I do know is that they're sorry they bought the place. Getting mixed up with that piece of land is not going to do anybody any good.
He tapped ash into the ashtray.
The yard has a well, doesn't it? I asked. Do you know anything about the well?
It does have a well, doesn't it?
Said Mr. Ichikawa.
A deep well. But I think they filled it in. It was dry, after all. Useless.
Do you have any idea when it dried up?
The old man glared at the ceiling for a while with his arms folded.
That was a long time ago. I can't remember, really, but I'm sure I heard it had water sometime before the war. Must have dried up after the war. I don't know when exactly, but I know it was dry when the actress moved in. There was a lot of talk then about whether or not to fill in the well, but nobody ever did anything about it. I guess it was too much bother.
The well in the Kasahara place across the alley still has plenty of water. Good water, I'm told.
Maybe so, maybe so. The wells in that area always produced good-tasting water. It's got something to do with the soil. You know, water veins are delicate things. It's not unusual to get water in one place and nothing at all right close by. Is there something about that well that interests you?
To tell you the truth, I'd like to buy that piece of land.
The old man raised his eyes and focused them on mine. Then he lifted his teacup and took a silent sip.
You want to buy that piece of land?
My only reply was a nod. The old man took another cigarette from his pack and tapped it against the tabletop. But then, instead of lighting it, he held it between his fingers. His tongue flicked across his lips.
Let me say one more time that that's a place with a lot of problems. No one, and I mean no one, has ever done well there. You do realize that. I don't care how cheap it gets, that place can never be a good buy. But you want it just the same.
Yes, I still want it, knowing what I know. But let me point out one thing. I don't have enough money on hand to buy the place, no matter how far the price falls below market value. But I intend to raise the money, even if it takes me a while. So I would like to be kept informed of any new developments. Can I count on you to let me know if the price changes or if a buyer shows up?
For a time, the old man just stared at his unlit cigarette, lost in thought. Then, clearing his throat with a little cough, he said,
Don't worry. You've got time. That place is not going to sell for a while, I guarantee you. It's not going to move until they're practically giving it away, and that won't happen for a while. So take all the time you need to raise the money. If you really want it.
I gave him my phone number. The old man wrote it down in a little sweat-stained black notebook. After returning the notebook to his jacket pocket, he looked me in the eye for a while and then looked at the mark on my cheek. February came to an end, and March was half gone when the freezing cold began to relent somewhat. Warm winds blew from the south, buds appeared on the trees, and new birds showed up in the garden. On warm days I began to spend time sitting on the veranda, looking at the garden. One evening, I got a call from Mr. Ichikawa. The Miyawaki land was still unsold, he said, and the price had dropped.
I told you it wouldn't move for a while, he added with a touch of pride. Don't worry. From now on, it's just going to creep down. Meanwhile, how are you doing? Funds coming together?
I was washing my face at 8 o'clock that night when I noticed that my mark was beginning to run a slight fever. When I laid my finger against it, I could feel a touch of warmth that had not been there before. The color, too, seemed more intense than usual, almost purplish. Barely breathing, I stared into the mirror for a long time, long enough for me to begin to see my own face as something other than mine. The mark was trying to tell me something. It wanted something from me. I went on staring at myself beyond the mirror, and that self went on staring back at me from beyond the mirror without a word. I have to have that well. Whatever happens, I have to have that well. This was the conclusion I had reached. 2. Waking from hibernation. One more name card. The namelessness of money. Just wanting the land was not going to make it mine, of course. The amount of money I could realistically raise was close to zero. I still had a little of what my mother had left me, but that would evaporate soon in the course of living. I had no job, nothing I could offer as collateral, and there was no bank in the world that would lend money to someone like me out of sheer kindness. I would have to use magic to produce the money from thin air. And soon. One morning, I walked to the station and bought 10 50-million-yen lottery tickets with continuous numbers. Using drawing pins, I covered a section of the kitchen wall with them and looked at them every day. Sometimes I would spend a whole hour in a chair staring hard at them, as if waiting for a secret code to rise out of them that only I could see. After several days of this, the thought struck me from nowhere. I'm never going to win the lottery. Before long, I knew this without a doubt. Things were not going to be solved so easily by just buying a few lottery tickets and waiting for the results. I would have to get the money through my own efforts. I tore up the lottery tickets and threw them away. Then I stood in front of the wash basin mirror and peered into its depths. There has to be a way, I said to myself in the mirror. But of course, there was no reply. Tired of always being shut up in the house with my thoughts, I began to walk around the neighborhood. I continued these aimless walks for 3 or 4 days, and when I tired of the neighborhood, I took the train to Shinjuku. The impulse to go downtown came to me when I happened to pass the station. Sometimes, I thought, it helps to think about things in a different setting. It occurred to me, too, that I hadn't been on a train for a very long time. Indeed, while putting my money in the ticket machine, I experienced the nervousness one feels when doing something unfamiliar. When had I last seen the streets of the city? Probably not since I followed the man with the guitar case from the Shinjuku West entrance, more than 6 months earlier. The sight of the crowds in Shinjuku Station I found overwhelming. The flow of people took my breath away and even made my heart pound. And this wasn't even rush hour. I had trouble making my way through the crush of bodies at first. This was not so much a crowd as a raging torrent, the kind of flood that tears whole houses apart and sweeps them away. I had been walking only a few minutes when I felt the need to calm my nerves. I entered a cafe that faced the avenue and took a seat by one of its large glass windows. Late in the morning, the cafe was not crowded. I ordered a cup of cocoa and half-consciously watched the people walking by outside. I was all but unaware of the passage of time. Perhaps 15 minutes had gone by, perhaps 20, when I realized that my eyes had been following each polished Mercedes-Benz, Jaguar, and Porsche that crept along the jam-packed avenue. In the fresh morning sunlight after a night of rain, these cars sparkled with almost painful intensity, like symbols of something. They were absolutely spotless. Those guys have money. Such a thought had never crossed my mind before. I looked at my reflection in the glass and shook my head.
This was the first time in my life I had a desperate need for money. When the lunchtime crowd began to fill the cafe, I decided to take a walk. I had no particular goal other than to walk through the city I had not seen for so long. I walked from one street to another, my only thought being to avoid bumping into the people coming towards me. I turned right or left or went straight ahead, depending on the changing of the traffic signals or the whim of the moment. Hands in pockets, I concentrated on the physical act of walking, from the avenues with their rows of department stores and display windows, to the back alleys with their garishly decorated porno shops, to the lively streets with cinemas, through the hushed precincts of a Shinto shrine, and back to the avenues. It was a warm afternoon, and nearly half the crowd had left their coats indoors. The occasional breeze felt pleasant for a change. Before I realized it, I found myself standing in familiar surroundings. I looked at the tiles beneath my feet, at the little sculpture that stood there, and at the tall glass building that towered over me. I was standing in the middle of the small plaza outside the high-rise, the very one where I had gone last summer to watch the people passing by, as my uncle had advised me to do. I had kept it up for 11 days then, at the end of which I had followed the weird man with the guitar case into the strange apartment house lobby where he attacked me with the bat. Aimless walking around Shinjuku had brought me to the very same place. As before, I bought myself coffee and a donut at Dunkin' Donuts and took them with me to the plaza bench. I sat and watched the faces of the people passing by, which put me in an increasingly calm and peaceful mood. It felt good for some reason I could not fathom, as though I had found a comfortable niche in a wall where people would not notice me watching them. It had been a very long time since I had had such a good look at people's faces. And not only people's faces, I realized. I had hardly looked, really looked, at anything at all over these past 6 months. I sat up straight on the bench and poised myself to look at things. I looked at the people. I looked at the buildings towering overhead. I looked at the spring sky where the clouds had parted. I looked at the colorful billboards. I picked up a newspaper lying close by and looked at it. Color seemed gradually to be returning to things as evening approached. The next morning I took the train to Shinjuku again. I sat on the same bench and looked at the faces of the people passing by. Again for lunch I had a donut and coffee. I took the train home before the evening rush hour started. I made myself dinner, drank a beer, and listened to music on the radio. The next day I did exactly the same thing. Nothing happened that day either. I made no discoveries, solved no riddles, answered no questions. But I did have the vague sense that I was, little by little, moving closer to something. I could detect this movement, this increasing closeness, whenever I looked at myself in the mirror above the sink. The color of my mark was more vivid than before, warmer than before. My mark is alive, I told myself, just as I am alive. My mark is alive. I repeated the routine every day, as I had done the previous summer, boarding the train for the city just after 10, sitting on the bench in the plaza by the high-rise, and looking at the people passing back and forth all day, without a thought in my head. Now and then, the real sounds around me would grow distant and fade away. The only thing I heard at those times was the deep, quiet sound of water flowing. I thought of Multicano. She had talked about listening to the sound of water. Water was her main motif, but I could not recall what Multicano had said about the sound of water, nor could I recall her face. All that I could bring back was the red color of her vinyl hat. Why had she always worn that red vinyl hat? But then sounds, little by little, came back to me, and once again I returned my gaze to the faces of the people. On the afternoon of the 8th day of my going into town, a woman spoke to me. At that moment, I happened to be looking in another direction, with an empty coffee cup in my hand. "Excuse me," she said. I turned and raised my eyes to the face of the woman standing in front of me. It was the same middle-aged woman I had encountered here last summer, the only person who had spoken to me during the time I had spent in the plaza. It had never occurred to me that we would meet again, but when she spoke to me, it seemed like the natural conclusion of a great flow. As before,
The woman was immaculately dressed in terms of both the quality of the individual items of clothing and the style with which she had combined them. She wore dark tortoiseshell sunglasses, a smoky blue jacket with padded shoulders, and a red flannel skirt. Her blouse was of silk, and on the collar of her jacket shone a finely sculpted gold brooch. Her red high heels were simple in design, but I could have lived several months on what they must have cost her. My own outfit was a mess, as usual. The baseball jacket I bought the year I entered college, a gray sweatshirt with a stretched-out neck, frayed jeans, and formerly white tennis shoes that were now of indeterminate color. Despite the contrast, she sat down next to me, crossed her legs, and, without a word, took a box of Virginia Slims from her handbag. She offered me a cigarette, as she had last summer, and again I declined. She put one between her lips and lit it, using a long, slender gold lighter the size of an eraser. Then she took off her sunglasses, put them in her jacket pocket, and stared into my eyes as if searching for a coin she had dropped into a shallow pond. I studied her eyes in return. They were strange eyes, of great depth, but expressionless. She narrowed her eyes slightly and said,
"So you're back."
I nodded. I watched the smoke rise from the tip of her narrow cigarette and drift away on the wind. She turned to survey the scene around us, as if to ascertain with her own eyes just what it was I'd been looking at from the bench. What she saw didn't seem to interest her, though. She turned her eyes to me again. She stared at my mark for a long time, then at my eyes, my nose, my mouth, and then my mark again. I had the feeling that what she really wanted to do was inspect me like a dog in a show, prize my lips open to check my teeth, look into my ears, and whatever else they do. "I guess I need some money now," I said. She paused a moment.
"How much?"
80 million yen should do it. She took her eyes from mine and peered up at the sky as if calculating the amount. "Let's see, if I take that from there and move this from here..." I studied her makeup all the while. The eyeshadow faint, like the shadow of a thought, the curl of the eyelashes subtle, like some kind of symbol.
"That's not a small amount of money,"
she said with a slight diagonal twist of the lips. "I'd say it's enormous." Her cigarette was only one-third smoked when she dropped it to the ground and carefully crushed it beneath the sole of her high-heeled shoe. Then she took a leather calling card case from her slim handbag and thrust a card into my hand.
"Come to this address at exactly 4 o'clock tomorrow afternoon," she said.
The address, an office building in the wealthy Akasaka district, was the only thing on the card. There was no name. I turned it over to check the back, but it was blank. I brought the card to my nose, but it had no fragrance. It was just a normal, white card.
"No name,"
I said. She smiled for the first time and gently shook her head from side to side.
"I believe that what you need is money. Does money have a name?"
I shook my head as she was doing. Money had no name, of course, and if it did have a name, it would no longer be money. What gave money its true meaning was its dark night namelessness, its breathtaking interchangeability. She stood up from the bench.
"You can come at 4 o'clock, then?"
"If I do, you'll put money in my hand?"
"I wonder,"
she said, a smile at the corners of her eyes like wind patterns in the sand. She surveyed the surrounding scene one more time, then smoothed her skirt with a perfunctory sweep of the hand. With quick steps, she disappeared into the flow of people. I went on looking at the cigarette she had crushed out, at the lipstick coloring its filter. The bright red reminded me of Multicano's vinyl hat. If I had anything in my favor, it was that I had nothing to lose. Probably. 3. What happened in the night? The boy heard the hard-edged sound in the middle of the night. He woke up, reached out for the floor lamp, and once it was on, sat up and looked around the room. The time on the wall clock was just before 2. The boy could not imagine what might be happening in the world at a time like this. Then the sound came again. From outside the window, he was sure. It sounded like someone winding a huge spring. Who could be winding a spring in the middle of the night? No, wait, it was like someone winding a spring, but it was not really a spring. It was the cry of a bird.
The boy carried a chair over to the window and climbed up onto it. He pulled the curtains back and opened the window a crack. In the middle of the sky hung a large white moon, the full moon of late autumn, filling the yard below with its light. The trees out there looked very different at night from how they did in the daylight. They had none of their usual friendliness. The evergreen oak looked almost annoyed as it trembled in the occasional puff of wind with an unpleasant creaking sound. The stones in the garden looked whiter and smoother than they ordinarily did, staring up at the sky impassively like the faces of dead people. The cry of the bird seemed to be coming from the pine tree. The boy leaned out of the window and looked up, but from this low angle the large, heavy branches of the pine hid the bird. He wanted to see what it looked like. He wanted to memorize its color and shape so that tomorrow he could find it in his illustrated encyclopedia. His intense desire to know had brought him fully awake now. Finding birds and fish and other animals in his encyclopedia was his greatest joy. Its thick volumes lined one shelf of his room. He had yet to enter elementary school, but he already knew how to read. The bird fell silent after winding the spring several times in succession. The boy wondered whether anyone else had heard the cry. Had his father and mother heard it? His grandmother? If not, he could tell them all about it in the morning. A bird that sounded just like the winding of a spring was sitting in the pine tree last night at 2 o'clock. If only he could catch a glimpse of it, then he could tell everybody its name. But the bird never raised its cry again. It fell silent as a stone up there in the branches of the pine bathed in moonlight. Soon a chill wind blew into the room as if delivering some kind of warning. The boy shuddered and closed the window. This was a different kind of bird, he knew, not some sparrow or pigeon which showed itself to people without hesitation. He had read in his encyclopedia that most nocturnal birds were cunning and cautious. The bird probably knew that he was on the lookout for it. It would never come out as long as he waited for it to appear. The boy wondered if he should go to the bathroom. That would mean walking down the long, dark corridor. No, he would just go back to bed. It was not so bad that he couldn't wait until morning. The boy turned the light out and closed his eyes. But thoughts of the bird in the pine tree kept him awake. The bright moonlight spilled in from beneath the curtains as if an invitation. When the wind-up bird cried one more time, the boy leaped out of bed. This time he did not turn on the light, but slipping a cardigan over his pajamas, he climbed onto the chair by the window. Parting the curtains just the tiniest bit, he peered up into the pine tree. This way, the bird would not notice that he was there. What the boy saw this time, though, was the outline of 2 men. He caught his breath. The men knelt like 2 black shadows at the base of the pine tree. Both wore dark clothing. One had no hat on, the other wore what looked like a felt hat with a brim. "Why are these strange men here in our garden in the middle of the night?" the boy wondered. "Why wasn't the dog barking at them? Maybe he ought to tell his parents right away." But his curiosity got the better of him at the window. He wanted to see what the men were doing. Then, without warning, the wind-up bird cried out again. More than once it sent its long, creaking sound out into the night. But the men did not seem to notice. They never budged, never looked up. They remained kneeling at the base of the tree, face to face. They seemed to be discussing something in low tones, but with the branches blocking the moonlight, the boy could not make out their faces. Before long, the 2 men stood up at the same moment. There was a good 8-inch difference in their heights. Both men were thin, and the tall one, the one with the hat, wore a long coat. The short one had on tighter-fitting clothes. The shorter man approached the pine tree and stood there, looking up into the branches. After a while, he began patting and grabbing the trunk with both hands as if inspecting it, until all at once he jumped up onto it. Then, with no effort whatever, or so it seemed to the boy, he went racing up the tree like a circus performer. The boy knew this tree like an old friend. He knew that climbing it was no easy feat. Its trunk was smooth and slippery, and there was nothing to hold on to until you got fairly high up. But why was the man climbing the tree in the middle of the night? Was he trying to catch the wind-up bird? The tall man stood at the base of the tree, looking up. Soon after, the small man disappeared from view. The branches rustled now and then, which meant that he must still be climbing up the tall pine. The wind-up bird would be sure to hear him coming and fly away. The man might be good at climbing trees, but the wind-up bird would not be that easy to capture. If he was lucky, though, the boy was hoping he might be able to catch a glimpse of the wind-up bird as it took off. He held his breath, waiting for the sound of wings. But the sound of wings never came, nor was there any cry. There was no sound or movement for a very long time. Everything was bathed in the white, unreal light of the moon. The yard like the wet bottom of a sea from which the water has just been removed. Entranced, motionless, the boy went on staring at the pine tree and the tall man left behind. He could not have torn his eyes away if he had tried. His breath clouded the glass. Outdoors, it must be cold. The tall man stood looking up, hands on hips, never moving, as if frozen to the spot. The boy imagined that he was worried about his shorter companion, waiting for him to accomplish some mission and come climbing down out of the pine tree. Nor would it have been strange for the man to be worried. The boy knew that the tall tree was harder to climb down than up. But then, all of a sudden, the tall man stalked off into the night, as if abandoning the whole project. The boy felt that now he was the only one left behind. The small man had disappeared into the pine tree, and the tall one had gone off somewhere. The wind-up bird maintained its silence. The boy wondered if he should wake his father, but he knew he would not get him to believe this.
"I'm sure you've just had another dream,"
his father would say.
It was true, the boy did often dream, and he often mistook his dreams for reality, but he didn't care what anybody said. This was real. The wind-up bird and the two men in black. They had just disappeared all of a sudden, that was all. His father would believe him if he did a good job of explaining what had happened. It was then that the boy realized. The small man looked a lot like his father. Of course, he was too short to be his father, but apart from that, he was exactly the same. The build, the movements. But no, his father could never climb a tree that way. He wasn't that agile or strong. The more he thought about it, the more confused the boy became. The tall man came back to the base of the tree. Now he had something in his hands, a shovel and a large cloth bag. He set the bag down on the ground and started digging near the roots of the tree. The shovel cut into the earth with a sharp, clean sound. Now everybody was bound to wake up, the boy thought. It was such a big, clear sound. But no one woke up. The man went on digging without a break, seemingly unconcerned that anyone might hear him. Though tall and thin, he was much more powerful than he looked, judging from the way he used that shovel. He worked steadily without wasted effort. Once he had the size of hole he wanted, the man leaned the shovel against the tree and stood there looking down. He never once looked up, as though he had forgotten all about the man who had climbed the tree. The only thing on his mind now was the hole, it seemed. The boy did not like this. He would have been worried about the man in the tree. The boy could tell from the mound of earth the man had dug that the hole itself was not very deep, maybe just above his own knees. The man seemed satisfied with the shape and size of the hole. He turned to the bag and gently lifted a blackish, cloth-wrapped object from inside it. The way the man held it, it seemed soft and limp. Maybe the man was about to bury some kind of corpse in the hole. The thought made the boy's heart race, but the thing in the cloth was no bigger than a cat. If human, it could only be an infant. But why did he have to bury something like that in my yard? Thought the boy. He swallowed the saliva that he had unconsciously allowed to collect in his mouth. The loud gulp he made frightened the boy himself. It might have been loud enough for the man to hear outside. Just then, as if aroused by the boy's gulp, the wind-up bird cried out, winding an even bigger spring than before.
Creak! Creak!
When he heard this cry, the boy intuitively felt that something very important was about to happen. He bit his lip and, without realizing, scratched the skin of his arms. He should never have seen any of this, he felt. But now it was too late. Now it was impossible for him to tear his eyes away from the scene before him. He parted his lips and pressed his nose against the cold window pane, transfixed by the strange drama that was now unfolding in his yard. He was no longer hoping for other members of the family to get out of bed. No one would wake up anyway, no matter how big a sound they made out there. I'm the only person alive who can hear these sounds. It was that way from the start. The tall man bent over, and handling it with the utmost care, laid the thing in the black cloth in the bottom of the hole. Then he rose to his full height and stared down at it lying there. The boy could not make out the look on the man's face beneath the brim of his hat, but he seemed somehow to be wearing a grim, even a solemn expression. Yes, it had to be some kind of corpse, thought the boy. Before long, the man reached a decision, lifted the shovel, and began filling in the hole. When he had finished shoveling, he lightly tamped the earth beneath his feet and smoothed it over. Then he set the shovel against the trunk of the tree, and with the cloth bag in his hand, moved away with slow steps. He never looked back. He never looked up into the tree, and the wind-up bird never cried again. The boy turned to look at the clock on his wall. Squinting in the darkness, he could just make out the time as 2:30. He kept watch on the pine tree for another 10 minutes, through the opening in the curtains, in case something should move out there. But an intense sleepiness overtook him all at once, as if a heavy iron lid were closing over his head. He wanted to know what would happen to the short man up in the tree and the wind-up bird, but he couldn't keep his eyes open any longer. Struggling to slip off the cardigan before he lost consciousness, he burrowed under the covers and sank into sleep.
4. Buying new shoes. The thing that came back home. I walked from Akasaka subway station down a lively street lined with restaurants and bars to the place where the office building stood, a short way up a gentle slope. It was an unremarkable building, neither new nor old, big nor small, elegant nor dilapidated. A travel agency occupied part of the ground floor, its large window displaying posters of Mykonos and a San Francisco cable car. Both posters looked faded from long duty in the window. 3 members of the firm were hard at work on the other side of the glass, talking on the telephone or typing at a computer keyboard. Pretending to be looking at the posters, I killed time watching the office scene while waiting for the hour to strike 4. For some reason, both Mykonos and San Francisco seemed light years from where I stood. The more I looked at this building, the more I realized how ordinary it was, as if it had been built to match the pencil sketch a small child might do if told to draw a building, or as if it had been consciously designed to be inconspicuous in its surroundings. As careful as I had been in checking the addresses during my search for the place, I came close to passing it by, it was so plain. The building's unobtrusive main entrance stood near the door of the travel agency. Skimming the nameplates, I got the impression that most of the offices were occupied by small-scale businesses, law offices, architects, importers, dentists. Several of the nameplates were shiny enough for me to be able to see my face in them. But the one for room 602 had faded with age to an indistinct color. The woman had obviously had her office here for some time. Akasaka Fashion Design, read the inscription. The sheer age of the nameplate helped to temper my misgivings. A locked glass door stood between the lobby and the lift. I rang the bell for 602 and looked around for the closed-circuit TV camera I assumed must be transmitting my image to a monitor inside. There was a small camera-like device in a corner of the lobby ceiling. Soon the buzzer sounded, unlocking the door, and I went inside. I took the absolutely unadorned lift to the 6th floor, and after a few uncertain moments in the absolutely unadorned corridor, found the door of 602. First, checking to be certain that the sign on the door said Akasaka Fashion Design, I gave the bell exactly 1 short ring. The door was opened by a slim young man with short hair and regular features. He was possibly the handsomest man I had ever seen in my life. But even more than his features, what caught my eye was his clothing.
He wore a shirt of almost painful whiteness and a deep green tie with a fine pattern. Not only was the tie itself stylish, but it had been tied in a perfect knot, every twist and dip exactly as one might see in a men's fashion magazine. I could never have tied a tie so well, and I found myself wondering how he did it.
Was it a talent, or was he born with the fruits of disciplined practice?
His trousers were dark gray, and he wore brown tasseled loafers. Everything looked brand new, as if he had just put it on for the first time a few minutes before. He was shorter than me. The hint of a smile played about his lips, as if he had just heard a joke and was now smiling in the most natural way. Nor had the joke been a vulgar one. It was the kind of elegant pleasantry that the Minister of Foreign Affairs might have told the Crown Prince at a garden party a generation ago, causing the surrounding listeners to titter with delight. I began to introduce myself, but he gave his head a slight shake to signal that it was unnecessary for me to say anything. Holding the door open inward, he ushered me forward, and after a quick glance up and down the hall, he closed the door, saying nothing all the while. He looked at me with eyes narrowed as if to apologize for being unable to speak because of the nervous black panther sleeping by his side. Which is not to say that there was a black panther sleeping by his side, he just looked as if there were. I was standing now in a reception room with a comfortable-looking leather sofa and chair, an old-fashioned wooden coat rack, and a floor lamp. There was a single door in the far wall, which looked as if it must lead to the next room. Beside the door, facing away from the wall, was a simple oak desk that supported a large computer. The table, standing in front of the sofa, might have been just large enough to hold a telephone book. A pleasant pale green carpet covered the floor. From hidden speakers at low volume came the strains of a Haydn string quartet. The walls bore several lovely prints of flowers and birds. One glance told you this was an immaculate room, with no hint of disorder. Shelves on one wall held fabric samples and fashion magazines. The office's furnishings were neither lavish nor new, but had the comforting warmth of the old and familiar. The young man showed me to the sofa, then went around to the other side of the desk and sat down facing me. Holding his palms out towards me, he signaled for me to wait a while. Instead of saying, "Sorry to keep you waiting," he produced a slight smile, and instead of saying, "It will not take long," he held up one finger. He seemed to be able to express himself without words. I nodded once to signal that I understood. To have spoken in his presence would have seemed inappropriate and vulgar. As if holding a broken object, he picked up a book lying next to the computer and opened it to where he had left off. It was a thick black book without a dust jacket, so I could not make out the title. From the moment he opened it, you could see that the young man's concentration on his book was total. He seemed to have forgotten that I was there. I would have liked to read something, too, to pass the time, but nothing had been provided. I crossed my legs, settled into the sofa, and listened to Haydn, though if pressed I could not have sworn it was Haydn. It was nice music, but the kind that seems to melt into air the moment it emerges from its source. On the young man's desk, apart from the computer, was an ordinary black telephone, a pencil tray, and a calendar. I was wearing virtually the same outfit I had had on the day before, baseball jacket, hooded sweatshirt, blue jeans, and tennis shoes. I just grabbed whatever came to hand before leaving the house. In this immaculate, orderly room, in the presence of this immaculate, handsome youth, my tennis shoes looked especially dirty and worn out. No, they were dirty and worn out. The heels practically gone, the collar an indeterminate gray, the uppers full of holes. Those shoes had been through a lot, soaking up everything in their path with fatal certainty. I'd worn them every day for the past year, climbing over the back wall countless times, stepping in dog shit now and then on trips down the alley, climbing down to the bottom of the well. No wonder they were dirty and worn out. Not since quitting my job had it occurred to me to think about what shoes I had on. Studying them so closely like this, I felt with new intensity just how alone I was, just how far the world had left me behind. It was time for me to buy a new pair of shoes, I told myself. These were just too awful.
Before long, the Haydn came to an end, an abrupt and messy end. After a short pause, some kind of Bach harpsichord piece started, though I couldn't have sworn this was Bach either. I crossed and recrossed my legs. The telephone rang. The young man marked the place he was reading with a slip of paper, pushed his book aside, and picked up the receiver. He held it to his ear and gave a slight nod. Focusing on his desktop calendar, he marked it with a pencil. Then he held the receiver near the surface of the desk and rapped his knuckles twice against the wood, as if knocking on a door. After this, he hung up. The call had lasted some 20 seconds, during which the young man had not spoken a word. In fact, he had not made a sound with his voice since letting me into the room. Was he unable to talk? Certainly he could hear, judging from the way he had answered the phone and listened to what was being said at the other end. He sat looking at his phone for a while as if in thought. Then he rose without a sound, walked around his desk, making straight for where I was sitting, and sat down next to me. He then placed his hands on his knees in perfect alignment. They were slim, refined hands, as one might have imagined from his face. His knuckles and finger joints did have a few wrinkles. There was no such thing as fingers without wrinkles. They needed a few, at least, to move and bend. But his fingers did not have many wrinkles, no more than the minimum necessary. I looked at his hands as unobtrusively as I could. This young man must be the woman's son, I thought. His fingers were shaped like hers. Once that thought entered my mind, I started to notice other points of resemblance. The small, rather sharp nose, the crystalline clarity of the eyes, the pleasant smile had begun to play about his lips again, appearing and disappearing with all the naturalness of a seaside cave at the mercy of the waves. Soon he rose to his feet in the same swift manner with which he had sat down beside me, and his lips silently formed the words, "This way, please." Despite the absence of sound, it was clear to me what he wanted to say. I stood and followed him. He opened the inner door and guided me through it. Beyond the door was a small kitchen and basin, and beyond that yet another room, much like the reception room in which I had been sitting, but a size smaller. It had the same kind of well-aged leather sofa and a window of the same shape. The carpet on the floor was the same color as the other one as well. In the middle of the room was a large workbench with scissors, toolboxes, pencils, and design books laid out in an orderly fashion. There were two tailor's dummies. The window had not merely a blind, but two sets of curtains, cloth and lace, both shut tight. With the ceiling light off, the room was gloomy, as on the evening of a cloudy day. One bulb of the floor lamp near the sofa had been turned off. A glass vase holding gladiolus blossoms stood on the coffee table in front of the sofa. The flowers were fresh, as if cut only moments before, the water in the vase clear. The music was not audible in this room, nor were there any pictures or clocks on the walls. The young man gestured silently again, this time for me to sit on the sofa. Once I had seated myself in accordance with his instructions, he took something like a pair of swimming goggles from his trousers pocket and stretched them out before my eyes. They were swimming goggles, just ordinary goggles made of rubber and plastic, much the same as the ones I used when swimming in the ward pool. Why he had brought them out here, I had no idea. I couldn't even imagine.
"Don't be afraid," the young man said to me.
Properly speaking, he said nothing. He simply moved his lips and fingers ever so slightly. Still, I had an accurate understanding of what he was saying to me. I nodded.
"Please put these on. Don't take them off yourself. I will take them off. You mustn't move them either. Do you understand?"
I nodded again.
"I will not harm you in any way. You will be fine. Don't worry."
I nodded. The young man walked behind the sofa and put the goggles over my eyes. He stretched the rubber strap around to the back of my head, and adjusted the eye cups so that the foam pads fitted around my eyes. The one way these goggles were different from the ones I always used was that I couldn't see anything through them. A thick layer of something had been painted over the transparent plastic. A complete and artificial darkness surrounded me. I couldn't see a thing. I had no idea where the light of the floor lamp was shining. I had the illusion that I myself had been painted over with a thick layer of something. The young man rested his hands lightly on my shoulders as if to encourage me. He had slim, delicate fingers, but they were in no way fragile. They had the assertive presence of the fingers of a pianist resting on the keyboard, and coming through them I could sense a kind of goodwill, or if not precisely goodwill, something very close to it.
"You'll be fine. Don't worry,"
they conveyed to me. I nodded. Then he left the room. In the darkness, I could hear his footsteps drawing into the distance, and then the sound of a door opening and closing. I went on sitting in the same position for some time after the young man left the room. The darkness in which I sat had something strange about it. The fact of being unable to see anything was the same as what I had experienced in the well, but otherwise this darkness had a certain quality that made it quite different. It had no direction or depth, no weight or tangibility. It was less like darkness than nothingness. I had merely been rendered temporarily blind by artificial means. I felt my muscles stiffening, my mouth and throat going dry. What was going to happen to me? But then I recalled the touch of the young man's fingers.
"Don't worry," they had told me.
For no clear reason, I felt that those words of his were something I could believe in. The room was so utterly still that when I held my breath, I was overcome by a sense that the world had stopped in its tracks and everything would in time be swallowed up by water, sinking to eternal depths. But no, the world was apparently still moving. Before long, a woman opened the door and stepped quietly into the room. I knew it was a woman from the delicate fragrance of her perfume. This was not a scent a man would wear. It was probably expensive perfume. I tried to recall the scent, but I could not do so with confidence. Robbed of my sight, I found my sense of smell had also been thrown off balance. The one thing I could be sure of was that the perfume I was smelling now was different from that of the well-dressed woman who had directed me to this place. I could hear the sound of the woman's clothes rustling as she crossed the room and gently lowered herself onto the sofa to my right. So lightly did she settle into the cushions of the sofa that it was clear she was a small woman. Sitting there, the woman stared straight at me. I could feel her eyes focused on my face. You really can feel someone looking at you, even if you can't see, I realized. The woman, never moving, went on staring at me for a long time. I sensed her slow, gentle breathing, but could not hear a sound. I remained in the same position, facing straight ahead. The mark on my cheek felt slightly feverish. The color was probably more vivid than usual. Eventually, the woman reached out and placed her fingertips on my mark, very carefully, as if inspecting some valuable, fragile thing. Then she began to caress it. I didn't know how to react to this, or how I was expected to react. I had only the most distant sense of reality. I felt a strange detachment, as if I were trying to leap from one moving vehicle to another that was moving at a different speed. I existed in the empty space between the two, a vacant house. I was now a vacant house, just as the Miyawaki house had once been. This woman had come into the vacant house, and for some unknown reason was running her hands all over the walls and pillars. Whatever her reason might be, vacant house that I was, and I was that and nothing more, I could do nothing, I needed to do nothing, about it. Once that thought crossed my mind, I was able to relax somewhat. The woman said nothing. Apart from the sound of rustling clothes, the room was enveloped in a deep silence. The woman traced her fingertips over my skin, as if trying to read some minute secret script that had been engraved there ages ago. Finally, she stopped caressing my mark. She stood up, came around behind me, and instead of her fingertips, used her tongue, just as Mei Kasahara had done in the garden last summer. She licked my mark. The way she did it, however, was far more mature than the way Mei Kasahara had done it. Her tongue moved and clung to my flesh with far greater skill. With varying pressure, changing angles and different movements, it tasted and sucked and stimulated my mark. I felt a hot, moist throbbing below the waist. I didn't want to have an erection. To do so would have been too meaningless. But I couldn't stop myself. I struggled to superimpose my own image upon that of a vacant house. I thought of myself as a pillar, a wall, a ceiling, a floor, a roof, a window, a door, a stone. It seemed the most reasonable thing to do. I close my eyes and separate from this flesh of mine, with its filthy tennis shoes, its weird goggles, its clumsy erection. Separating from the flesh is not so difficult. It can put me far more at ease, allow me to cast off the discomfort I feel. I am a weed-choked garden, a flightless stone bird, a dry well. I know that a woman is inside this vacant house that is myself. I cannot see her, but it doesn't bother me anymore. If she is looking for something inside here, I might as well give it to her. The passage of time becomes more and more unclear. Of all the kinds of time available to me here, I lose track of which kind I'm using. My consciousness goes gradually back into my flesh, and in turn the woman seems to be leaving. She leaves the room as quietly as she came in. The rustle of clothing, the shimmering smell of perfume, the sound of a door opening, then closing. Part of my consciousness is still there as an empty house. At the same time, I am still here, on this sofa, as me. I think, what should I do now? I can't decide which one is reality. Little by little, the word here seems to split in two inside me. I am here, but I am also here. Both seem equally real to me. Sitting on the sofa, I steep myself in this strange separation. Soon the door opened and someone came into the room. I could tell from the footsteps that it was the young man. He came around behind me and took off the goggles. The room was dark, the only light the single bulb of the floor lamp. I rubbed my eyes with my palms, accustoming them to the world of reality. The young man was now wearing a suit. Its deep gray with hints of green was a perfect match for the color of his tie. With a soft smile, he took my arm, helped me to stand, and guided me to the back door of the room. He opened the door to reveal a bathroom on the other side. It had a toilet, and, beyond the toilet, a small shower stall. The toilet lid was down, and he had me sit on top of it while he turned the shower on. He waited for the hot water to begin flowing, then he gestured for me to take a shower. He unwrapped a fresh bar of soap and handed it to me. Then he went out of the bathroom and closed the door. Why did I have to take a shower? I didn't get it. I finally understood as I was undressing. I had come in my underpants. I stepped into the hot shower and washed myself with the new green soap. I rinsed away the semen sticking to my pubic hair. I stepped out of the shower and dried myself with a large towel. Beside the towel I found a pair of Calvin Klein boxer shorts and a T-shirt, both still in their wrappers and both my size. Maybe they had planned for me to come in my trousers. I stared at myself in the mirror for a while, but my head was not working properly. I threw my soiled underwear into a wastebasket and put on the clean, white, new underpants, the clean, white, new T-shirt. Then I put on my jeans and slipped my sweatshirt over my head. I put on my socks and my dirty tennis shoes and finally my baseball jacket. Then I stepped out of the bathroom. The young man was waiting for me outside and guided me to the original waiting room. The room looked as it had earlier. On the desk lay the same opened book, next to which stood the computer. Anonymous classical music flowed from the speakers. The young man had me sit on the sofa and brought me a glass of chilled mineral water. I drank half the glass.